Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life is produced by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, a division of the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences. Visit us online at whyradioshow.org.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. On today's episode, we're talking with Derek Black about the right to education, literacy, and the injustice of zero-tolerance policies at schools. A funny thing happened to me as I was reading for today's episode. I became livid. Now, this isn't too surprising. As people who know me will attest, I can run hot, especially when faced with injustice. But this was a very special kind of anger, one I reserve only for schools. The book I was reading is titled Ending Zero Tolerance, The Crisis of Absolute School Discipline, written, not surprisingly, by today's guest. It's about the ways that unjust punishments undermine education and sometimes destroy student lives. So I don't think I was wrong to be angry, but that doesn't explain why my reaction was so visceral and aggressive. I will confess that I both hated school and wasn't very good at it. It's also true that nothing particularly bad happened to me there. I was never bullied or friendless. I was never targeted by a malicious teacher or vice principal. I was suspended once for writing graffiti, but had no real impact on my life except to add street cred. But here I am now, a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor with a radio show that's about to celebrate its 10th birthday. So what am I so angry about? It's worth noting that I'm in awe of teachers. My mom, dad, two aunts, and two grandparents were teachers. My wife and I are, of course. And my second book is dedicated to the professor that changed my life. My daughter's teachers have been mostly great, as have her school staff. So it isn't the people that anger me. It's the institution. It's politics and policies. My fury is driven by the impersonal aspects of the school that bulldoze individuals for a bureaucratic good. From the institutional perspective, students aren't people. They're data points. They're the most affected, yet they have the least power. Their advocates, too, are the least effective when they represent particular kids and most powerful when they enforce rules. School authority comes from regulations, not care. Student individuation is always volunteer work because the day-to-day institutional functioning treats all kids as indistinguishable. My anger, it seems, comes from a feeling of helplessness. It involves recognizing that the real locus of power is not the student's well-being, but the continual negotiation between career administrators and the well-organized extremists whose sole goal is to mold students to their own image. The result? History textbooks full of lies, sex education that teaches nothing about sex, underfunding, low teacher salaries, and students who become expendable in the battle to liberalize gun rights. This reveals the contradiction at the heart of modern schooling. The very thing that justifies school authority is that which schools cannot do, replace parents. Schools are built on the old doctrine in loco parentis, the notion that schools are authorized to act because they are substitute parents acting in the kid's best interest. But this misunderstands parental authority, which isn't legitimized by biology or power. It's the result of undivided attention. Let me explain what I mean. My daughter has been the most interesting thing in my life for 13 years, and I've spent significantly more time thinking about her than anything else in my whole life. What makes me Adina's dad is that I understand all the ways she is different from anyone else. Yet all the school bureaucracy knows is what makes her the same. Conformity is a form of silence. The best schools identify gifted students to give them opportunities and seek out struggling students to provide assistance. Everyone else just muddles along. I was a middle-of-the-road student. No one paid attention to me except to punish me when I was bad and celebrate my natural talents when I discovered philosophy. The rest of the time, school offered me nothing. And had I wanted more, the school's response would have been to demand that I work harder to distinguish myself. This reveals another contradiction. School was supposed to educate me, but instead it made me responsible for the attention I didn't get. Did I have a right to demand more than I earned? Did I have a right to a better education? Does anyone? These are the questions of today's episode, and they lead to yet another contradiction. Schools are collectives. but rights are individual. Schools seek patterns, but rights denote specific people doing specific things. This is why the only time schools appeal to rights is when they're trying to take things away. Administrators like acting as parents because parents trump rights. But what if we flip this on its head and ask not what rights kids have in the face of bureaucracy, but what rights they have to demand schools be better? On today's episode, we're going to ask whether people have a right to an education, to literacy, and to, among other things, fair punishment. If they do, this means that schools have to meet students where they are, not the other way around. If they don't, it means that school is a privilege, and only those who are said to have earned it are entitled to its fruits. This, it seems to me, leads to inequality and injustice, and that's worth being angry about. And now our guest. Derek Black is a professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law. His areas of expertise include education, law and policy, constitutional law, civil rights, evidence, and torts. He's the author of numerous articles and the books Zero Tolerance, The Crisis of Absolute School Discipline, and Education, Law, Equality, Fairness, and Reform. Derek, thanks for joining us on Why.
Thanks for having me on.
We're pre-recording the show today, so we won't be stopping for comments, but please send us your thoughts at askwhy@und.edu. Post them on Twitter or Instagram at Why Radio Show, or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/whyradioshow. You can find links to them and find out how to send us questions for future shows at whyradioshow.org. So, Derek, it seems to me that asking whether we have a right to education is a new question. I've skated around it a lot in my work, but I don't recall many conversations that address it directly. Is this a new question, or is it just new to me?
Well, I don't think it's a new question. I think there's a newness to it because all of a sudden it's more important than it has been recently. And I think you go through a lot of the challenges that we are facing today with our school system. And so now all of a sudden, people want a way to fight back. And so we are revisiting this question of, what are students' rights to public education? And there's been a couple of sort of high flashpoints in history that have, made that question become more and less important, and now it seems it's becoming more important for this generation.
Are we at one of those flashpoints, or do we just sort of look at them for guidance?
I think we're at one of those flashpoints. If you see or if you look at what's been happening to our school system, and I think, first of all, I should say I felt like I wanted to take the first 3 or 4 minutes of your introduction and make it the preface to the second edition of my Zero Tolerance book. So we can negotiate that later.
But I'll have my people call your people.
Unfortunately, we don't have any people. But in any event, all right. So, but I do think it's a really important moment in time as we see, education becoming more bureaucratic. We see the public education system itself struggling, right? And, we hear a lot of rights talk out of our Secretary of Education, for instance, about the right to go for a private school, to go to a voucher or a charter school. And I'm sitting here sort of, banging my head against the wall and saying, well, what about the right to a decent public education? It's quite strange to me that we have an administration and also commentators sort of co-opting that rights talk to talk about to write to something other than public education. That is what gives me an enormous amount of concern and makes me say, look, we really need to focus on, the core right to get something decent at your local public school rather than these other things.
I want to talk about those things specifically in a little bit, but you keep using the phrase rights talk, and we're all really familiar with it. We hear it all the time. There's YouTube rants about people having rights at Walmart. When people talk about rights, do they address it differently than lawyers do? Is there a distinction between the moral approach to rights and the legal and constitutional approach to rights?
Yeah, there's an enormous difference. I mean, when lawyers talk about rights, they mean that the Constitution or a statute, but primarily the Constitution, entitles you to something. You could go into court and say, I'm entitled to this, the state's not giving it to me, or the state's interfering with this right, and that the court would have to step in. Whereas, as you described, look, I think outside of sort of the legal environment, we talk about it more of a normative or value or moral-based claim upon government. And I think, you know, depending on who you're talking to, some people tend more towards morals, some others tend more towards the law. But there's a huge variance there. And I think it's also worth noting, I think one of the things that I have struggled with more recently in my scholarship is, how do we interpret the rights talk of our forefathers and our founders? You know, what did they really mean when they said, you know, you have right to life, liberty, and property? Were they just engaging in rights talk of a sort like people might today? Or were they talking about those sort of legal constitutional protections that someone ought to be able to go into court and sue for? I mean, I kind of think it's actually somewhere in between those two things quite often, but in any event.
It seems to me that there's an inherent ambiguity because, of course, rights aren't delineated as clearly in the Constitution as perhaps you or I might want. And then there's also this notion that there are certain rights retained by the people, right, that aren't mentioned. And so then you get the Supreme Court and the federal courts, and they have decisions that enumerate these things and explain these things. Once it gets to that point, is it clear, or does it just muddy the waters? How much can we get, I don't know, certainty about rights by looking at the case law and by looking at the discussion between the courts?
I mean, I think we can get a pretty good deal of certainty by reading the court cases, but I think there is an enormous ambiguity maybe embedded in what you're talking about, which is, you know, when they were passing, or when we were ratifying our Constitution, when we were passing the 14th Amendment, the legislators did a lot more to protect people's rights. So if you thought about who is it that's going to keep, you know, Jack from getting his, you know, school rights, you know, trampled on, they wouldn't have thought necessarily the courts would be the first line of defense. They thought we would be responsive to Jack and his concerns, and we know what our ideas are about education, and we'll jump in there and legislate. Right? I mean, there was a lot of civil rights legislation before and after the Civil War. And what we've seen across time, arguably, is our legislators not remaining true to our constitutional commitments, and then it falling upon our courts to sort of enter the breach, to close that gap. And that's not to say the courts are right or wrong. I just think in the modern world, we think about our Constitution and what it does in maybe a much different way than what our founders did. Now, some people would say, okay, well, that means courts shouldn't be doing anything. To me, the answer is no. We have to adapt to the times. I mean, society has changed, our legal culture has changed, and the venues in which we, you know, sort out these issues has changed to a certain extent. I don't think our founders meant to bar courts from getting into these issues.
Do the courts ever use the moral language of rights in their decisions, or is it entirely precedent-based and text-based? And I'm thinking, is it Korematsu, the decision about the impropriety of putting Japanese Americans in internment camps? That's the right one, right?
Well, they said it was. They didn't find any impropriety there.
Right. Yeah. So Korematsu is the one that says it's okay, right?
Yeah, it's okay.
If someone comes along and says it's not, can they say in the decision, this is just wrong, this is morally reprehensible? Does that have the power of law, or do you have to appeal to a particular statute, a particular clause in the Constitution, a particular text that we hold as having some sort of important value that trumps opinion?
I mean, that's a fascinating question. I think maybe we might say it varies on the issue, it varies on the speaker. And I think that the default rule would be go to the constitutional text first, right? The Constitution explicitly protects it. Let's not get into moralistic conversation. If there's a clear logical argument under which the text would protect it, let's go to the logic rather than the moral claim. But yet, we can't separate our logic from morals. I mean, you're a philosopher, and you've probably got a better explanation as to why we can't. But, you know, sort of our morals certainly affect our logical reasoning, and maybe that's a flaw in the logic. But nonetheless, that's the way it goes, right? Our logic is bounded by the norms in which we exist to some extent. And so that's by way of saying, look, I think we see people reach for morals when it resonates deeply enough. I was reading or rereading portions of A Team of Rivals the other day. It was about Abraham Lincoln and sort of lead up to his presidency, and the anti-slavery debate comes up in it. And I think it was Seward who makes this searing appeal to stopping the slave trade and stopping the growth of slavery. And he makes it from a moral claim. He lays out this argument that there's no way that our Constitution itself is legitimate if it tolerates the immorality of slavery, and that there's this sort of higher moral, you know, sort of law that sort of we must adhere to. And when I read that text, I was like, yeah, I like that. You're sort of, maybe I can use that for some other argument. But sure enough, you know, some other anti-slavery people were very upset with Seward's appeal to this higher moral law, because they say we can't enforce that, number one. Number two, it's going to change across time. And, you know, we want rules that we can enforce that say stay consistent. So that's sort of one example of, you know, slavery seems like an obvious place where you ought to be able to go into court and make a moral argument. On the other hand, there's reasons why maybe that wasn't a good idea. You know, you look at Kennedy and his discussions of LGBTQ rights, and you really see morality, it seems to me, coming into play quite a bit there.
This is Justice Kennedy, not President Kennedy.
Yes, Justice Kennedy and his various decisions recognizing, you know, the right to same-sex marriage, recognizing, you know, the right of same-sex couples to engage in intimate relationships. There's a tremendous amount of moral talk in there. And he does it through the word liberty. I mean, liberty is probably the vaguest word in the Constitution that we could look at. So what does it mean to have a right of liberty? Well, he talks about this, you know, ability to set one's own destiny, to sort of enter the relationships that are fulfilling for individuals, and the state to not interfere with that. But there's a tremendous amount of morality. Obviously, those opposing same-sex marriage, you know, sort of claim that he's actually bringing immorality into the conversation. And on his side, I think there's this argument of, no, this is the moral, decent way that we respect individuals' liberty. So, you know, yes, there is plenty of moral talk, but we do have to ground it in some specific constitutional idea or clause.
If we flip that around, I'm going to ask a question which I'm going to have to explain, but is there a floor, a sort of a stupidity floor? And what I mean by that is the following. We were talking about Immanuel Kant, and I had the students ask whether or not Kant would justify the draft. And one of the students said, yes, but you have to draft everybody. And in the conversation, it meant that you have to draft infants too, that infants have to be in the army. And so I said to the class, let's assume that Kant wasn't a moron. and that if you get – when you're dealing with a philosopher and you get an answer that is just completely stupid, like infants should be drafted into the army, then you know you've made a mistake. Is there an equivalent concept in the law where the courts can look at something and say, this is just dumb? This doesn't make any sense. It runs counter to just not even basic morality, but our basic understanding of the world. And so this can't stand. The law can't stand. The decision can't stand because it's just stupid. Is there anything like that, or is that itself so ambiguous a concept that it doesn't really solve problems?
Well, I mean, I think there's a few places where you can see this come up. I mean, one is this appeal to rule of law. And I forget the case I was looking at recently. But there, you know, sometimes the court, when it doesn't have a good answer in the text, might say, well, that's just entirely inconsistent with the rule of law. Maybe that's another way of saying that's just stupid. But what we're saying is, look, we've set up this system to run in a certain way, right? And there may not be a specific clause that prohibits, you know, this or that, but like, this is just entirely inconsistent with the way our laws operate, right? And so I think talking about the presidency is one of those examples when they say, look, no man is above the law or woman is above the law, right? And so it is just completely ridiculous to take a position that somehow or another the president or anyone else in this country might be able to operate outside of the normal rules that we apply to everyone else. So you see it there. We also see these sort of references to historical tradition, which is to say, look, we've always done it this way. We've done it this way for a reason. And now you're just sort of throwing out some completely different way of doing things. So we do have these normative values. Courts don't like to use stupid, but I think there's sort of a touch of, you know, this is inconsistent with all of our historical traditions. This is inconsistent with the way Congress has done it for, 200 years or what have you. So we do see that, but I think it's more subtle.
And is there, and I'll ask this with an eye towards our discussion of education, is there an umbrella method, way of doing things that everything under the law has to follow? And what I'm really asking is education a special case? We talk about education differently than we talk about most things. And in your book, and we'll talk about this in more detail after the break, in your book, there's a whole discussion of how punishment in schools do not follow the same rules as punishment elsewhere. Is education a special case, or when we start talking about education and rights and constitution and laws, that we have to be consistent with the way that we talk about everything else, driving, jobs, taxes, insert your favorite item in the list here. Is education the same as everything else and just an instance, or is it fundamentally different and we have to think about it differently?
Well, I think we have to think about it differently. And I think two different ways. I mean, one is just the status of the child, him or herself, right? You know, you're making the comment earlier about drafting everyone. Well, I was teaching voting the other day, and we were talking about, voting equality and, who all should get to vote. And in my mind, well, the students were saying, let's let everyone vote. Da, 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 it doesn't matter as long as you're here. And I said, well, kids too. And, well, how can we have a rule that says everyone and not include kids? I was like, kind of going back to your stupid point. I go, well, yeah, that makes sense, but we're not going to let 8-year-olds vote. We're just not going to do that. No matter how committed we are to the idea that everyone affected by the law ought to have a say in it. And so there is something special about children that says, look, there's certain stuff we're not going to give them access to or expose them to because they're children, and that seems wholly appropriate. We're not going to expose them to the draft any more than we're going to grant them the right to vote. So that's one thing. On the other side, I think that public education is a special institution. And maybe it dovetails into what I just said, is that we realize these children are in a stage of development, that requires that we have special obligations to these children, that we do special things for them, and that we also realize if we don't treat them special, that we are setting ourselves up for disaster when they're adults and quote-unquote no longer special.
This is a great segue into the larger conversation about rights, about responsibilities, and how we deal with people who are developing rather than we regard as full persons. So we'll deal with all of that stuff after the break. You're listening to Derek Black and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll be back right after this.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We're talking with Derek Black and asking whether there is a basic right to education and literacy and whether or not things like zero tolerance policies undermine that. And I'm in a particular position because I've been in school my entire life. I think that this year I'm probably in the 42nd grade or something like that. And so I get very, bothered when students say things like, well, this is just school. We need to prepare for real life, as if school isn't real life. And I always respond that the consequences of what happened in school are real. You can get diseases. You can get hurt. You can get smart. You can get dumb. You meet friends. You decide what's important to you. All the things that happen in school are real, but they should be at least somewhat safer. They should be more experimental. You do have permission in school to try things and think about things that you might not have the opportunity to do. I decided in my life that I didn't want to leave that venue, ironically, but other people want to get out as quickly as possible. So, Derek, I think the question that I want to ask you related to this is, to what extent does school treat students like it's real life? And to what extent are students treated as whole people, full people, or are they a different class because they're younger and don't have the same kind of authority that, say, a 49-year-old has?
Well, I wish I knew what real life was. you and I have the benefit of some alter life, so I don't know. But I think that whole people, a whole person concept is an important one. And, you know, we have this idealized notion that our schools once taught our children as being whole people. You know, I don't know for sure that's entirely true. It's my sense of things that that was probably more so the case, that our children were whole people before. But I think what we increasingly see now is sort of the robot, making our children into robots, and they're all the same, and they don't have unique status, and they all need to learn the same thing, and all the teachers need to teach the exact same thing, and they teach at the same time of day with the same book, and on and on and on. And I think that's really dangerous idea, if nothing else, for the soul of the teachers. I mean, the students don't really know it's the same thing as everyone else in the
right.
nation. It's the same book. They don't know it was the same thing last year. And so I think there's a debilitating thing that happens to teachers when we do that. But it also limits, you know, sort of the freedom of thought. I mean, when I think, and now we are really just philosophizing, but I think, you know, I think about what the real value of public school is. It's not learning the events that occurred in some particular historical period, or learning that one is more important than another, or, you know, learning rules and this. I think it's really about that development as an individual, the exploration, and figuring out how to explore. I mean, I think that's the key, which I'm sure resonates with some of your listeners, is that, you know, the information we give children is not as crucial as the skills that we give them. And those skills are going to develop differently, and the kids have to have that freedom. So, I do worry that we're not educating them as whole persons, and the discipline code is another sort of clear aspect of that all children must, you know, sit up in their desk in the same way and be quiet in the same way. And, you know, as I say in my book, most children do not have the capacity to be quiet all day. I mean, let's just sort of do a thought experiment. Let's just say the rule is children shall not speak once they enter the schoolhouse gates at 7:30 until lunchtime. They shall be allowed 5 minutes of conversation at the beginning of lunch so that they can order what they want to eat, and then they shall proceed to eat and be quiet and say nothing else until we release them at 3:20. Now, I venture to guess that there's a few children who could live up to that rule, but most of them can't. And the problem with that rule, notwithstanding its absurdity, is the idea that all children are the same. And if we set a rule, or we set a curriculum, or whatever, I mean, that they'll rise to that occasion. And that, you know, anyone who's got children knows that is completely a completely misguided notion. Children don't just do what we say because we said it. Right? They don't think something's important just because we said it was.
So it's not just your kid, too.
it's not just my kid, too. And so now you talk to the standardized test makers, you know, and the state-level bureaucrats, and they'll say, but how will we know that they're learning anything? And I have to be honest and say, well, you know, I think it is tough. It is tough to know what kids are learning when we actually try to teach them the stuff that I say is important and give them those skills. It's not easy to test critical thinking. That's at least not on a standardized exam. But I think that's really what school ought to be doing. I think that's the stuff that kids get excited about. You know, you sit at home and, you know, as I do, start lecturing I'm not meaning to lecture them, but it comes off like a lecture, you know, sort of imparting information and wisdom. And, you know, they're not interested in that, right? They may be interested in having a conversation with me about something, but they're not interested in just, you know, following the conversation in the direction that I want it to go.
So there's another tension here. You keep using the word persons, and you're talking about this social idea of a person who has his or her own desires and who is developmental or not. Yet persons in the law mean something different. My daughter in a couple of weeks is becoming bat mitzvah. So in Jewish law, she's going to be an adult, but she's not going to be an adult. And I'm not going to get rent out of her no matter how much I try. And the law, by saying she was a person, the Jewish law means something different than her being a fully developed human being. When you say persons in that sense, in what kids are developed to be able to do, that means one thing. Does the law treat kids as persons in the same way as it treats adults? Do kids have the same basic rights, the same basic freedoms? I mean, I know they can't vote and they can't drive, but in terms of the philosophical concept, political concept of a person, does it apply to children?
Great question. I guess my short answer, I think they're like 2/3 of a person. that's not written down anywhere, but I think.
And not 3/5, because that's a whole other problem.
Yeah,
right?
That's a whole other problem. But I will say they used to be more like 1/3 or not even 1/3. And so during the 60s and 70s, the court really did cross this bridge in which they began extending, you know, freedom of speech and Fourth Amendment, which is the right against, you know, search and seizure. They started extending those rights to children in a way that had never been extended before. And there were that was a controversial. There were people in the court who said, wait a minute, you know, kids don't have rights in school. They come, they sit down, they shut up, they do what the adults say. And at least the majority of the court been said, no, that's not true, right? They are persons who have First Amendment rights. They don't shed them at the schoolhouse gate. So why only 2/3 of a person now? Well, because after the court said that, they've spent, you know, 3 decades scaling back those rights and talking about, well, yeah, they have the right to free speech, but it's not really the same as adults, or they have the right to privacy, but it's not really the same as adults, or they have the right to not be searched, but not in the same way as adults. So they're probably more like 2/3 of a person as opposed to a full one, at least as far as the Constitution is concerned. And, you know, there's really this asinine legal debate going on right now in Texas that I think typifies this. So, you know, the court says students have the right of free speech. It also says because they have the right of free speech, you can't force them to pledge allegiance to the flag. Right? That the individual child's decision to say, you know what, I want to kneel just like the NFL players have done because, you know, this is how I feel about America right now. That is the individual child's right. Well, there's a rule in a Texas school district that says, well, that's fine, but if you're going to opt out of the Pledge of Allegiance, we need parental consent for that. We need the parents to say it's okay for you to not engage, not do the Pledge of Allegiance. And the Texas Attorney General is now siding with the school district and saying, that's right, you know, the school can require that the student get parental consent. If that's the case, first of all, I think that's legally wrong. But if a court were to validate that, what they're really saying is that the child has no First Amendment right. that their First Amendment right is subject to whether mom and dad thinks they have it and they've informed, you know, the principal of it. I mean, that to me is an incredible concept that is, you know, further scaling back the personhood of children.
It also seems to me to be a wasted teaching opportunity. Instead of demanding the permission slip, why not have a conversation about why and have the students think for themselves? And I guess that gets back to the standardized test question and the developmental question. When we have conversations like this, is it about education or is it about order? Is the school rule in Texas and the Attorney General, are they thinking about how students learn, or are they thinking about controlling people in a large-scale public institution and bureaucracy? What's the goal there?
Well, I think it's control, and it is, you know, trying to make it hard for people to diverge from the party line, whatever the party line is. And I think there's an enormous constitutional tension there. In the first school discipline case, which was called Goss v. Lopez, the question was, you know, do you have to give students some sort of process before you kick them out of school? And by process, we mean notice of what you've done and a chance to respond, a chance to say, I didn't do that, or that's not right, or that's not fair. And the Supreme Court said, yes, before you exclude a child from school, you have to tell them what it is they've done, give them a chance to respond. And one of the sort of key rationales in that case coming from the court was, what is the lesson we're teaching children if we don't give them notice of what they've done, if we just kick them out? And the Supreme Court said, public schools are actually the first experience that 95% of the people in America ever have with government. This is your introduction to government. And when government deals with you, will it deal with you in a way that's respectful and has some back and forth, or will it simply discard you however it sees fit without any explanation? You know, I think the problem as bureaucracies get involved is that we forget that learning experience, that we're actually teaching a lesson when we discipline a child, and it's sort of a back and forth lesson, and that we respect your side of the story, and we're at least going to hear you out before we do something to you. But I think it's hard as bureaucracies grow bigger to stay true to those ideas.
This is a really abstract criticism, and I'd like you to talk a little bit about the case that made me so angry. In your introduction to your book, you talk about a kid who's suspended for having a knife in his notebook. Would you talk about that case a little bit and how it represents the problem that you're trying to figure out?
Yeah, so there's a middle school student in Loudoun County, Virginia. It's just over the river, county over from Washington, D.C. When he was going there, it was still a pretty small county. Loudoun's big and pretty wealthy at this point. But when he was going there, it was about a decade or so ago, he had a friend who he had known to be suicidal in the past. You know, she'd done things to herself and had issues, and I think she had treatment and whatnot. Well, he sees her on a Monday morning, and she shows up, and she says, you know, I've been feeling suicidal over the weekend, and I've brought a knife to school with me. I'm, you know, thinking about hurting myself. And his response, which I think is the appropriate response of any good developing person, is to try to help her. And he says, you know, can I have it? Can I have the knife? And she says, it's in my, you know, my locker. You can go get it. It's inside of a notebook. So he goes to the locker, and actually I don't think he ever touched or even saw the knife, or at least there's no indication that he did. He just grabs the book binder and takes it and puts it in his own locker, puts it in safekeeping. Well, like any good middle school, you know, the story spreads quickly. You know, everyone knows about it, and in fact the principal finds out about it before lunch. I think it was 10 or 11 o'clock, something like that. And so the principal then calls this young man, Benjamin Ratner, calls him to the office and says, you know, do you have the knife? And he says, yeah. He said, well, can you go get it for me? Which actually I think is an incredibly telling fact. You know, we read through things so quickly we don't stop to think about what are the humans doing at this point. The principal says, can you go get it for me? Now, if we just sent out a blind survey, a standardized survey, how many principals, if noticed that a child or a middle school student had a knife, would allow them to go get that knife and retrieve it themselves? I would venture to guess that less than 0.1% of principals right. in the United States would right. say, yes, let the child go get the knife. But that's what this principal did, and it's telling, and that he realized that there was absolutely no danger, that this child wasn't a danger, and that he really hadn't done anything wrong. So the child goes and gets the binder and brings it back, and in fact, the principal says, you know, Benjamin, I'm sorry, you did the right thing, but I'm going to have to suspend you. You know, Benjamin must have been floored at that point. I actually tried to track him down, and did track him down. I left a voicemail, but I didn't want to invade his privacy too much, so he... Maybe I'd already done too much at that point. He didn't call me back, and I left it at that. But I really did wonder, you know, what sort of went through his mind and what his experience was. Because you don't get that from the papers, what his experience was, what he was thinking. But in any event, you know, the principal suspends him, notwithstanding the fact that he'd said you did the right thing. I think his mom must have been equally shocked, because when he got home a little bit later, there was another phone call that said, you know, you guys need to show up at the superintendent's office, because we're considering expelling him. We're not just going to suspend him for a few days. We're going to kick him out of school for the rest of the school year. And so they have a hearing, and sure enough, they expel him for the rest of the year. Yeah, the courts get involved, and the part, I mean, that story thus far upsets me, but then what upsets me even more is that, you know, the court, who I believe is really there to protect rights, to protect students in these sorts of situations, won't get involved to protect Benjamin either. It upset you. It still upsets me now. It's a story that just defies any sort of logic that I can come up with. I mean, they offer one, but I don't think it's a legitimate logic.
So while the shouts are in my head, there are a variety of things that come to mind and a couple questions. The first is, one of the things that doesn't come off when you tell the story, which is pure speculation on my part, which is, how does this girl feel who's already suicidal, and now someone tries to help her and love her, who has done the right thing for her, and he's gotten in trouble? Does that make her more suicidal? That seems problematic in and of itself. Then we have two competing questions that I want to ask. The first is this a violation of due process? Is this an unjust punishment? And under the law, and whether or not the Benjamin is a person, can he appeal to the due process aspects of the law? But after that, I want to ask and have a conversation. What if he turned around and said, by suspending me, you are violating my right to an education? Because that's obviously the point of us being here. But we'll get to that in a second. Can Benjamin say, look, this is arbitrary. This is it doesn't make sense. You followed some procedure, but I'm not represented in that procedure. And that in itself is unjust. Can he do that part?
Yeah, he can. I mean, try to break down the due process as simply as I can. I mean, there's sort of two types of due process. One is about, did you jump through the right hoops with this child? Did you call him in? Did you tell him what he had done? Did you give him a chance to respond? You know, did you have a hearing, right? That's what we call procedural due process. And that's largely a box-checking exercise. Like, did you jump through the hoops, as I said? Then there's what we call substantive due process, which is a question about rationality, which is, well, do you have a good reason for suspending the kid? Right? Does it make sense? You know, we know you went jump through all the hoops, but does it make sense? And it's very, very easy case for a court to say you didn't jump through the right hoops, right? The hoop is give them notice. You didn't give them notice. You violated that. On this question of rationality, courts are extremely, extremely deferential to the school's rationality. And I think there's a lot of undeveloped thinking by the courts there, that they don't want to get involved. They've never wanted to get involved. They, you know, the general rule is we don't second guess the substantive decisions of school officials. And I appreciate that. I don't think that courts should second guess everything a school does. On the other hand, if the question is, whether this is a rational action or a rational rule, for that matter, by the school, I think we've at least got to go through the analysis before we reach that decision. But what we saw in Benjamin's case is no more than a sentence or, well, literally, I think I say in my book, I think they spent one paragraph, a single paragraph, dealing with and justifying the rationality of what the school had done. I don't think that's serious, serious analysis or serious attention. So I think, you know, in part, you know, go back to your question, yes, he has rights. My feeling is a lot of courts don't respect those rights. They don't. They're not explicitly rejecting them, but they're sort of they're not respecting them. They're not taking them seriously, and so kids aren't getting a fair chance to have their day in court.
I want to interrupt and ask this, which is, are they not respecting those rights because those rights are not adequately codified in law? Or are they not respecting those rights because judges are, as we're all completely immersed in at the moment, ultimately political figures who are responding to political pressures? What's the major cause of this lack of respect? Is there just no tradition of children's rights and therefore it needs to be developed? Or are they ignoring it for rhetorical, political, strategic reasons?
I think there's not a tradition there on this question of sort of the rationality of the punishment. The initial assumption of the court during the 60s and 70s is if we can just get schools to have hearings, to sort of give the procedural due process, they'll make good decisions, right? That'll fix it. That was the hope. We didn't have zero tolerance then, right? We didn't have the level of suspensions and expulsions then that we have now. So, you know, I don't know. Maybe the court was right. Maybe it was wrong then. But the court has never had to come back to the serious question of, well, if giving a hearing is not enough to make suspension or school discipline rational, do we need to come up with some new rules to help it be a little bit more rational? So because the Supreme Court has not sort of revisited the basic rationality of the rules themselves in any serious way, we're stuck with, well, as long as you've jump through the hoops of giving a hearing, it's probably a rational decision by the court. So just an enormous amount of discretion there. And I think the court hasn't revisited that again, because again, there's a lot of concern that, you know, courts will make things worse rather than better. You know, that school officials will begin acting defensively and, you know, making decisions not based upon pedagogy, but on what they think a court is going to say. And I don't think that's a good place either, right? I don't think our educators should be running around making decisions about children based upon what they think courts are going to say about it.
Is there a sense, and again, I think I might have to explain this, but is there a sense that schools are afraid of the children? And what I mean by that is starting in the 1950s when America develops a real teenage culture and rock and roll starts to embody sexuality and violence, there's a clampdown on teenage life. And then the 1960s and 70s makes it worse. And then in the 1980s and 90s, this becomes very politicized in terms of two strikes laws and increasing prison population. And when I look at high schools, particularly, one of the things I see, and this is now expanding to middle schools, a deep-seated fear of teenage sexuality, of teenage rebellion. Is some of this a court fear of the power and the uncomfortableness that teenagers in particular cause some people to have? Or is it really just in the educational, strict educational realm? And again, we just don't have that tradition to work with.
That's a tough question. I mean, I think if you read some of the cases of about 10 years ago dealing with drug testing of students, what you see there is this fear of drugs, right? Sort of that kids are going to be plagued by them. And like, you know, you're a parent, I'm a parent, I certainly worry about that. The thing that's striking, though, is if you read cases that are 10 years older than that, 20 years, 30 years, like people have always been worried about their kids getting into stuff, right?
Right.
And every time you see a court talk about it, it's always the worst time in history. Drugs are run amok, and the kids and doing this and that. And so, you know, so there is this sort of slippery slope, you know, fear about how bad things will get if we get involved, or how bad they'll get if we don't let schools do this or that to kids. So there is that. But I guess I might also come back to your statement earlier about, you know, just who's on the court. I mean, I do think, and this is not a political party issue. I mean, you know, lawyers, there is a good deal of conservatism in us all, right, that we actually believe you have to follow the Constitution. You don't do what you think is right. You follow the Constitution, right? We don't just put it up for Democratic vote every time. We do what the Constitution says. And so lawyers as a group, legal structures as an institution, maintain the status quo, right? And the status quo is government power in many respects. And so I do think there's this built-in, or I know there's this built-in deference to government power that's also at play here. So you've got a child population that's at risk of being overrun with drugs, and we've got this sort of benevolent government power on the other side. And, you know, with those two factors, yeah, let's defer to the state on this.
Okay, so let's revisit the Benjamin case, and let me ask that second question that I asked. So suppose, independent of the due process or lack thereof, Benjamin comes back with an ACLU lawyer in tow and says, you can't suspend me, you can't expel me, because that would violate my right to education. I have a basic fundamental right to have access to this school and to learn. Is that a coherent statement? Does that make sense? And what can you do with it?
Yeah, that is coherent. And I don't even think you have to talk about constitutions. I mean, the one thing that actually entitles students to any sort of due process is the idea that there's a right that's been taken away. So the only time the government has to give you process for anything is if you've got a right that they're taking away. And so, you know, the court said kids have a statutory right to be there, right? Actually, they're compelled by law to be there. And so his right to education triggers the due process. And then we get into, I think maybe what you're getting at is, well, let's assume, Benjamin did break the rules, but let's change the facts for a minute and say, you know, there's a rule against fighting. Benjamin got in a fight and he punched someone, and now they've suspended him for it. Does Benjamin still have a claim to say, you can't just suspend me for the rest of the year because I have a right to education?
Right,
and
exactly.
That has come up in some state court cases, and the way that sort of filters out is to say, well, it depends on some courts have gone, well, that doesn't apply to discipline. This sort of rights talk doesn't apply to suspensions. If there's a rule and you broke it, that's it. I think those cases are problematic, but for the most part, what you see is a little bit of a if the court does the analysis correctly, a little bit of balancing, which says, well, you know, how important is the state's interest here? Like, can they, you know, is suspending a kid for fighting, putting aside the facts of the individual case, is that a legitimate rule? Does the state have a sufficient basis for that? And the courts would say, yeah, I mean, fighting, that seems reasonable. Then there's another question that we says, well, had the state gone about this in the least restrictive means, which is to say, okay, we understand the state has a good reason for prohibiting and punishing kids who get in fights, but does that mean they can, like, kick you out of school forever? Right? Is that necessary? Or does it just mean maybe you should have in-school suspension instead? And so what we're looking at, or often looking at, is if there is a sufficiently important right on the part of kids, even if the school has a reason to take it away, we want them to do it in the least intrusive way, right? So let's use a different example, talking. Sure, yeah, the school can say no talking, or, you know, no talking during instruction, or you have to obey rules and the teacher tells you to be quiet. Does that mean they could, you know, if you started school on September 1st, they could suspend you for the next 8 months because you didn't shut up when the teacher told you? I mean, that seems to be extreme. Isn't there some lesser way to take care of it? And that's part of what I try to talk about in my book is on this question as well. The courts have refused to evaluate the threat the child is posing in relationship to the school's need to remove them. Instead of engaging in that balance, which would be the appropriate thing, what courts have tended to say is, did the school have a rule? Is that a legitimate rule, i.e. no talking? Did the student violate that rule? Yes. Okay, we're done. There was a rule. It was a legitimate. They suspend them, and then the punishment's up to the school. I think a serious constitutional evaluation of that shows that can't stand. It cannot be the case that a school could suspend and expel a student for the rest of the year because they talked during the first period of class. But if you look at some of the Supreme Court opinions, including Benjamin Ratner's, which is a Court of Appeals decision. If you look at Benjamin Ratner's opinion in the Fourth Circuit, it is consistent. It is consistent with the idea that a school could suspend a student for the rest of the year for talking in school.
There's a lot that I want to ask here, but I actually want to take us down a more complicated road to see if we can get back here, because I want to take this away from punishment and ask about education in itself. So suppose someone comes along and says, I've been in school for 10 years and I don't know how to read. You have violated my right by not teaching me to read. It's not that I didn't come to school. It's not that I caused problems. I came. I didn't learn how to read. I have a right to literacy and you didn't give it to me. The first question is that legally coherent? Is there a tradition for that? And second, suppose someone comes along and says, you didn't give me literacy. You didn't teach me to read. I'm going to sue for damages. I know that brings in a whole other can of worms, but what I'm really asking is, we're talking about the right to education in a very abstract way, and what we're really talking about for the most part is the right to access to educational institutions, the right to be at school. And what seems to be the next question is there a right to education in and of itself, to learning? And if a student doesn't learn, if a student isn't taught properly, has the school not just not done its job, but has the school violated a right that a student has?
Well, on the question of tradition, I would say there's not a good tradition of that sort of right, that individual right that you're talking about. We should say quickly, and then we can come back to it or move on, whatever. Now, we do have a statute for students with disabilities, and that does have individual rights in it. And those students can get damages. Those students can get compensation. They can get remedial stuff. And so there's a very robust sort of set of statutory rights for students with special education disability needs. For the rest of the students, there isn't that tradition as an individual. What we do have, however, and this is a fine distinction, so I'll try to make it clear, is this notion that the state has a duty to all children. Right? So, you know, whether my son could come in and sue and say, hey, you didn't give me what I needed, you know, we don't have a tradition of that. Could my son's school, group of children as an entirety, say, hey, this school stinks, you know, three quarters of us can't read, you know, the state isn't doing what it needs to do? We do have a tradition, at least three decades of tradition in our state courts, in which state Supreme Courts begin to say, yes, states do have a duty to provide an adequate and equal education to all students across the state. But again, what we're talking about is a duty to the students as a whole, not, yeah, I'm going to let individual John or Jimmy come in here and sue because they didn't get what they needed.
So we're making this distinction, which I guess I'd like to ask you about, between a right and a duty. How do those two things relate?
Oh, now we're going to put the people to sleep. So they
like philosophy. It's okay. You have permission.
Yeah. So I guess the answer is, like, generally speaking, anytime there's a duty of one party, that means somebody else has a right. That's the general rule. So like 90% of the time, if someone has a duty to do something, that means somebody else has a right to receive it. We've got a few exceptions. There's one exception to that, which courts have recognized in personal liability cases, which is to say, yeah, you know, law enforcement has a duty, right, to go out and investigate crimes. And, you know, if it were the case that, you know, the police officers were just eating donuts all day and never went out and investigated crime, maybe we could bring a claim about that. But that doesn't mean that when Derek Black calls and says, hey, there's a break-in at my house, that they have to drop everything else they're doing, drop all their other investigations, or prioritize Derek ahead of everyone else, right? So they have a duty to do their job, but that doesn't mean Derek has a right to have them come out to his house when he says, get here now. And so we have seen that with law enforcement. We've seen it with fire departments. And that makes sense, right? Because there are these sort of priorities that police have to make, right? Like, what areas are we going to be policing at this time of day or not, and, you know, how much money are we going to spend? So we see it there. In the education context, I'll have to be honest, the courts have not wanted to touch that distinction. They have used the word education as a fundamental right. And some of my friends go, well, do they really mean that? Do they mean that it's a fundamental right, or are they really saying that government has a duty? And so, you know, that hasn't been fully fleshed out there. But I think if you look at the holistic body of, you know, education quality, you know, litigation, what you would see is that probably what the court is doing is talking about a duty to students as a whole, not a right that individual students can enforce. And now I'm going to say something else that makes no sense to anyone, which is, but, you know, John Q. student, you know, sues the state. And so it's like, you know, John Smith against, you know, North Dakota, and says, you know, I'm not receiving an adequate education. Here's the evidence in regard to me and my peers and all of this. And the courts will entertain this and take this case and never get into this distinction between the individual right and the group duty. But the remedy that they will give to, you know, Mr. Smith is not, you know, a remedy for him as an individual. It would be a remedy aimed at his entire school or the entire state, potentially.
So, and you used these words, and I was going to ask about them too. Duty seems group-oriented, collective. Right seems individual. And so we're at that same problem that I articulated in the beginning of the episode, which is, when I express my frustrations about schools, it's frustration as an individual, not a group. Michael Apple, a philosopher of education, who's been on the show a couple times, makes a point of saying, look, despite the fact that we have criticisms of our public schools, the public school graduates more people than it ever has in history. It has more diverse population than it ever has in history. It has been more successful in most regards than it ever has in history, and that we shouldn't just denigrate the schools because they're easy to denigrate. And I am totally sympathetic to that. But I'm really interested in this notion of the individual experience of a student, because this right is individual in nature. So what remedy is there at all for the student who isn't taught to read? Is it simply a bootstrap, right? You have to pull yourself up. You have to make yourself read. And of course, we forget that the phrase bootstrap actually implies impossibility, right? That you can't pull someone up by someone can't pull themselves up by their own bootstrap. That's the point, right? So, but is it ultimately there is no right, because ultimately we think it's the individual student's responsibility to solve this problem for him or herself with his or her family. That seems to me to be problematic. So I'm going to just repeat the question perhaps in a different way. Is there anything that an individual can do to say, I have this right to literacy, I have this right to read, I have this right to write, you haven't taught me, you owe me something as an individual, not because I have special needs, but because I'm me, a person in a system? Is there any way to deal with that? And I know it's a hard question.
No, I just don't want to give you the answer. So, I think the cold, hard reality is that as the law stands now, the answer is no. There is no such thing. I should say there is no current enforcement of an individual right of the sort you just mentioned. And I hesitate to say that because, I mean, right, that's a cold, hard truth. Now, I'll say there is another side of this, and this is maybe the dirty underside of litigating social justice. And it even goes back to school desegregation. That when we talk about education reform and we talk about education rights in the courts, we have, when I say we, I mean civil rights attorneys and even the plaintiffs who step forward, we have always been fighting for the next generation. We've never fought for the current generation. And that's not a critique, but that is the nature of the beast. So, you know, those children, well, there are a few children who were part of the school desegregation movement who got to see the fruits of their labors, although those were sometimes the dirty fruits. But in any event, but most of the time, those folks understood that they were fighting for their grandkids or their own kids, and that's troubling. And I think when we talk about our state constitutional claims to an adequate and equal education, those children are fighting for the next generation. I don't remember if his first name was John, but Mr. Leandro brought a lawsuit in North Carolina. And, you know, by the time the Supreme Court had done anything serious with his case, he was in college, right? And I think, you know, Mr. Leandro understood that when he brought that case, it wasn't going to benefit him. And so that's the nature of it. And I guess we could have a philosophical discussion about the nature of social justice and whether we ought to focus more on the current generation than the later one. But that's the way civil rights advocates have attacked these issues. And I guess I would, you know, we could add to that and go, well, I mean, I'll pose it to myself. Is that a smart strategy? In one respect, it is. Because if we were really going to get serious about what it meant to remedy the harm of school desegregation for children who were in the 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th grade, whatever it was back then, who had already suffered a decade of educational deficit and harm. Although a lot of many of the African American schools were really great, but they were underfunded. And that child graduates and can't get a good job or can't go to college. What's the remedy for that kid? Well, the remedy for that kid is a lot of money, right? Lost wages, lost education opportunity that can never be gotten back. But if that was the claim that you marched into, you know, federal district court in Somerville, you know, South Carolina, and said, we want these children to get, you know, checks for what segregation has done to their lives, hey, the court wouldn't have done it. There's no way. You know, there is a reality, which is, no, there's nothing for you as an individual right here and now. It's for the next generation. And maybe that's the best we can hope for. On the other hand, I mean, I have written a couple of pieces. And Jim Ryan, who's president of University of Virginia now, a great education scholar, has made the same point that maybe there are some ways that we could force the here and now on states, and it would actually do a better job of compelling them to provide a good education. So here in South Carolina, for instance, I wrote an op-ed. We were dealing with our school funding and quality issues, and the state isn't, you know, acting in good faith in my mind, or at least not coming up with a remedy in short order. And look, you can't make the legislature pass new funding bills. No one can do that. It's up to them. But I said, but what a court could do, they could say, we know that the children in these 10 schools are receiving an inadequate education. And we know that in the suburbs of Columbia, South Carolina, those kids are getting a pretty good education. Those are pretty good schools, pretty good teachers, and pretty good funding. And so what we are going to do while the state is figuring out how to fund education better is we are going to order the state to immediately allow for the enrollment of these children across those school district boundaries. I mean, can you imagine that? Now, that like 1,000 kids show up at, you don't know Irmo, but Irmo High School and knock on it. We're here today. We're here for our public education, right? And you have this happening across the state. I can tell you that state would move with lightning speed to come up with a remedy for the educational challenges that children in struggling schools face. So, you know, maybe we ought to be more creative about what we're asking for so that we can, instead of me telling you no, there's no remedy for John Q in the here and now, maybe we can find one, and we just haven't been bold enough to do that yet.
So I want to say first, because it's been rolling around, that the statement that you just made, that social justice is always concerned fighting for the next generation, is one of the more powerful things that anyone has ever said on the show. It's immensely intuitively right and meaningful, and both incredibly inspiring and tremendously disappointing at the same time. So, I mean, thank you for that, because I think it helps me understand things. And so then we have this question, which is, does that mean that the remedies are purely political, or can there be court-based legal actions for the constitutional scholars? You and I very briefly, when we met before the show, had a brief reference to the teacher strikes across the state. Is that something that we can understand in terms of the right to education? Are teachers fighting for that? And is that something that is a substitute for working with the courts? Is it supplemental to working with the courts? Is it parallel but independent? How do we address this problem?
Yes.
Socially and legally, right? Yeah. No, please. Socially and legally, what's happening there?
Well, I should start off by saying there has never been – well, I shouldn't say never. That's dangerous. I can't think of an instance in which a court has announced a major civil rights or education victory in which the remedy just happened because the court said so.
Right.
That just doesn't happen. And so one of the things that we emphasize with our school quality – adequacy and equity litigation is that if you're just going to go into court and litigate your case, you might as well hang it up and go home. Unless there is grassroots advocacy that places pressure on the legislature or the local school board or whoever the state power may be, unless there is a coordinated effort outside of that court to make real people outside of the court live up to the ideas that the court has announced, it will not happen. And we've seen that in a number of states. So, you know, I don't want to – I probably engage in too much court glorification, so I offer that to say we shouldn't glorify them too much. And it's often the case, to be quite honest, that a court will only recognize a right after people have been beaten on the doors for a decade, right?
Right.
That they are not a progressive group. They are the ones who follow the wave of the people rather than leading the waves themselves. So we recognize that. You know, as the teacher strikes, I think, yeah, this is a great example of, you know, we have seen a lot of harm done to public education since the recession. You know, we've got about 30 states spending less today in real dollar terms on public education than they did before the recession started. Stock market is on fire. Tax revenues are on fire. We're spending less today on public education in real dollar terms than we did in 2008 before the recession. And that's a good – that's sort of the major explanation for why we saw teachers across this nation striking this year. I said, look, we've been dealing with, you know, tattered books for a decade. We've seen our class sizes grow for a decade. We've seen our salaries remain stagnant for a decade while everyone else is doing well. We've seen fewer people coming into the teacher pipeline. We see students with needs that aren't being met. And the states won't do anything, right? And, in fact, we had people come in and make fancy, you know, constitutional claims like we've been talking about. You've got a right to an adequate, equal education. And legislatures have kicked the can down the road or, you know, found ways to get out of it or delay. And the teacher said, we've had enough. Enough. And so what is amazing is how that show of strength by teachers achieved something in a matter of weeks or 2 weeks that would have taken, you know, attorneys years to achieve. And so there is something quite amazing in the power of the people to actually say, we don't need a court to enforce, you know, the state's duty for education. We'll do it ourselves. Now, I don't want to be too naive about that either. You know, the people that those teachers were negotiating with, I do not believe they're committed to the constitutional obligations that they have. And so they did what they needed to do to get the teachers to go back to work. They have not changed their approach to public education.
So you have a wonderful piece, which I'll link to on the website, about the history of the rights to education that, stemming from the 14th Amendment and after the Civil War. And one of the things you point out, which you've alluded to, is that we have that whatever rights there are to education are on the state level, not on the federal level. And we're running out of time, so I'll ask a sort of generic question, which is there reason for optimism? Do you feel optimism about the future of the rights of education, not just education institutions, but do you think that progress is being made and will be made in terms of this tradition of thinking education in terms of rights, or do you feel pessimistic and do you think that in the end it's going to be the vicissitudes of politics and social interaction that makes this decision? As a constitutional lawyer, is there reason for optimism?
Yeah, two-part answer. In the spring of 2016, I thought we were on a verge of a new constitutional era as to education, and partly because what I had sort of discovered in regard to the right to education. I thought I had found, you know, the Holy Grail, as one of my colleagues called it, although he cautioned, he wrote a nice little essay cautioning against Holy Grail thinking, but I thought I had it. And I stumbled across it, you know, sort of like an archaeologist just sweeping dirt away looking for bones, and then they find an alien artifact or something. But I don't know if that's ever happened. But in any event, so I was extremely optimistic. As I see the Supreme Court changing now, I worry not that I didn't find the Holy Grail, but that some judges might just smash it, and if you break the Holy Grail, you can't put it back together at some later point. So, and that's sort of a political conversation: who's on the court? But you know, what is that Holy Grail? At least as I would describe it. Well, there's this fascinating thing that happened, in 1865 to 1868, which was, you know, we just had a Civil War, and Congress had to put our nation back together. Right? We've got illiteracy rates in the South that are four times the literacy rate in the North. And I'm just talking about white folks, you know. And, of course, we've got millions of African Americans who've been held in slavery for whom it is a crime, has been a crime to read and write. Right? So Congress has to come up with a solution. How are we going to build democracy in a place that, you know, a lot of white folks can't read and they can't vote either? A lot of white folks, without land couldn't vote. White women couldn't vote. And then, of course, all the African Americans. How are we going to make democracy? And Congress passes the Reconstruction Act. We have got a number of states that ratify the 14th Amendment, but the 14th Amendment isn't part of the Constitution yet. And so Congress says, here's our plan, Southern states. If you want to be part of this nation again, right, we've got a few conditions for you. And in fact, the Constitution gives Congress the authority to place those conditions. The Constitution says Congress has the authority to ensure what we call a Republican form of government in every state. By Republican form of government, we'll just say democracy, to ensure a working real democracy there. And so Congress says, we know how we're going to do that. One, you're going to let everybody vote. Not women. You're going to let all the males vote. Right? And this is before we even passed the 15th Amendment. And you're going to rewrite your constitutions and make sure you're providing public education. Reconstruction Act is 1867. Congress does this. In a matter of 2 years, every single Southern state amends its constitution to affirmatively provide for public education. Now, most people have looked at these state constitutions independently of Reconstruction, independently of Congress. They just said, okay, well, you know, North Carolina's constitution dates back to 1868 on education, South Carolina's 1868, Texas 1870, you know, that's the years. What I did was say, wait a minute, this didn't happen by accident. That what Congress was saying is that what it means to have a democratic society, we have come to learn through error because we didn't have it in the South, means public education, and you're going to do it. And all the southern states do it. And in fact, the last three states to be readmitted, Mississippi, Texas, and Virginia, in their readmission statute, Congress specifically writes down that those states shall never take away those education rights from the people. Right? So we have this cataclysmic shift about what it means to be a democratic society, what it means to comply with the Constitution, and I'll also argue that those rights become vested in the 14th Amendment itself. There's additional history that I think that sort of confirms my sense of how things change, which is the northern states then begin amending their constitutions of their own volition, and when they do so, they include education. And following the Civil War, we had, you know, another 20 or so states to be admitted. No state would ever again be admitted to the United States of America without a clause in its state constitution guaranteeing education. So I take that history, I take those events to say education became, in a constitutional sense, a federal constitutional sense, a duty that states must carry out. Now, that doesn't answer the question of what's that education supposed to look like. I've got plenty of research on that, but we probably don't have time to talk about it. But this idea that has been accepted as conventional wisdom for the past, you know, several decades, this sort of idea that, you know, states can have or not have public education as they see fit, I argue is completely refuted by that period in 1865 to 1868, that our federal constitution does obligate the provision of public education. And then, you know, we want to talk about later some other time what that education looks like. I'm happy to come back.
The problem is that what you just did was start an episode rather than end an episode. I have about 4 more hours of questions that I want to ask you. I will tell the audience that you summarize a lot of this in this piece that I referenced earlier, so I will put it on the website. It's incredibly interesting, and in the context of this conversation, it's really helpful and really exciting, and I guess all you need to do is find someone with standing to get yourself to the Supreme Court and make that argument. And when you do, I will be there by your side. Derek, thank you so much for joining us on why this has been fascinating and challenging and really wonderful.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Derek Black and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussion About Everyday Life. We've been talking about the right to education, and I will be back with a few thoughts right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Y Radio Store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We were talking with Derek Black about whether or not there is a right to education and what the consequences of that might be. Does it mean that people can get a certain amount of education? Does it mean that students shouldn't be punished? Does it mean that we have to appeal to the law or social justice? These are deep questions. But what I found tremendously interesting was that at the end, when Derek offered a optimistic solution, he had to go back to Reconstruction. He had said several times during the discussion, there's no tradition of individual rights of students. There's no tradition of appealing to the rights for quality of education. And at the same time, what he meant was we have to find that thread that extends back to the beginning. And he thinks he has. And that's amazing to me. It's amazing to me that the solution to this problem is not something new, but something old. That when we look at the time that America was most divided and came back together, the rules for coming back together are the place we have to look for the solution. Now, maybe this shouldn't be surprising. Maybe that division is also the cause of our problems. We didn't spend a lot of time talking about racial disparity in education, but we know it's there. We didn't really talk about Brown versus Board of Education and the idea of separate but equal being unconstitutional, but we know it's there. We didn't talk about the social forces that divide student from student, but we know they're there. Instead, we talked about school as an institution, and we talked about the laws and the structures that help establish what a school is. And if we want to find that answer, we have to go back to the place where it all started, or rather, I should say, to the place where we got to rethink it once again. And that's Reconstruction. The right to an education is essential to a democracy. Democracy is built on citizens participating and having all the capacities, the capacity for argumentation, the capacity for reasoning, the capacity for discussion, the capacity to learn. And when you're rebuilding a democracy after a crisis like the Civil War, you want everyone to have that. Now it's 2018, and we want people to have that for the first time. Again, I'm not sure what the words would be. But the tradition tells us that if we want to solve a problem like inadequate education, we should go to the place where we had to solve all of the problems. We have to go to the place when we had to rethink who we are, and that involves Reconstruction. Law is a tradition, and if we're going to appeal to the Constitution and the cases and the discussion, we have to appeal to history. Derek reminded us that the problem that we face is a long-standing problem. It feels new because it's relevant, but it's as old as democracy itself. You've been listening to Jack Russell Weinstein and Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Thank you for listening, and as always, it's an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. Skip Wood is our studio engineer. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua y Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.